studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Tuesday, September 22, 2015. Alexis Tsipras has been re-elected in Greece and is claiming a four-year mandate. We'll turn to Harry Konstantinidis for more. And Dr. Michelle Goodwin discusses our system of mass incarceration in the U.S., particularly as it affects women and girls. Plus, Deepa Iyer joins us to discuss her new book, We Too Sing America, South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh Immigrants Shape Our Multicultural Future. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Christina Mislan. She's an assistant professor of journalism studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. Hi, Christina.
Hello, Sonali.
Pope Francis kicks off a highly anticipated visit to the United States this week. It will be the 78-year-old's first ever visit to the U.S. CNN, which described the Pope as bringing tough love to the U.S., described the setting for his visit in this way. Francis is stepping into an intense domestic debate on issues close to his heart, including income inequality, climate change, abortion, the definition of marriage, religious freedom, and immigration, end of quote. Coinciding with his visit is a strike by low-wage federal workers led by the group Good Jobs Nation. Workers who cook and clean for lawmakers and their staffs in Washington, D.C. have been demanding living wages since their work was turned over to private companies. Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders plans to join their rally in D.C. today. Pope Francis just left Cuba before coming to the U.S., and while there, he met Fidel Castro, and he called for a, quote, revolution of tenderness. The Pope had played a critical role in the resumption of U.S.-Cuba relations. Well, Christina, the Pope is so popular that he's being treated like royalty. Is that because of, rather than in spite of, his progressive-leaning positions on several issues?
I think some of it. So, apparently recent polls have indicated that not only people who identify as Catholics, but non-Catholics as well, are really excited about Pope's visit. And that includes a lot of progressives because of his stance on climate change and economic inequality, the current anti-immigration rhetoric, and the fact that he represents a South American identity helps, especially with the immigration issue. But, I also think we need to remember his stance on women's reproductive rights. And so here's where I think maybe some progressives can take this opportunity to challenge him. The ability to be able to decide when to parent, right, that's including access to birth control and the choice to have an abortion if desired and needed, that's directly related to access to education, higher income, et cetera. So the issues, the progressive agenda that he's very much pushing forth is directly is actually related to women's ability to actually have access so that we can address issues of economic inequality, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so I think maybe this is a really good moment to push him on that.
Right. And by the way, on tomorrow's episode of Uprising, we'll hear from a march of immigrant women heading to D.C. to coincide with the Pope's visit in order to draw attention to the cruelty of immigrant family detention. If KPFK's general manager decides to let you hear that show, that is. If you tune in and hear something other than Uprising with Sonali, just go to our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, to hear the band broadcast. Martin Shkreli, the 32-year-old CEO of a pharmaceutical company named Turing, has come under fire from social media users who denounced his company's decision to buy a drug named Daraprim and then raise its price by more than 5,000%. Daraprim is used to treat toxoplasmosis and is mostly prescribed to people with weakened immune systems, such as those with HIV and cancer. Before Turing's acquisition, the pill cost $7.50 each. Now Shkreli, a former hedge fund manager, has decided to charge $750 a pill and has justified the price jump, saying it will pay for research and development on toxoplasmosis. But doctors have responded saying there's no real demand for research into a disease that only impacts about 4,000 people a year and for whom the pill is now out of reach. Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Elijah Cummings yesterday wrote a letter to Turing Pharmaceuticals saying they would be conducting an investigation into the price increase. Well, Christina, price gouging by pharmaceuticals has actually started to become a campaign issue. Is it an apt symbol of capitalist exploitation?
Well, it's definitely an example of what's wrong with the medical system, where pharmaceutical companies can have so much influence on the healthcare system. And so in this instance, one of the rationales for this dramatic and sharp increase is the need for more research, as you mentioned, well, maybe we should also ask how pharmaceutical companies are funding this research. So there are numerous criticism and accusations of companies using shortcuts where people are pressured, researchers are pressured for giving favorable results, testing on people without their proper approval, using drugs for unapproved uses. I mean, that's just a few. Some researchers are paid by pharmaceutical companies that market the drugs under study. And so it's not only a question of capitalist exploitation, that's a huge part of it, but we also have to look at how the healthcare system is directly impacted. It raises questions about who actually has access to care.
Right. And finally, the state of Louisiana plans to retry the last remaining member of the so-called Angola 3. Albert Woodfox, who has been held in solitary confinement for more than 40 years, will be tried for a third time for the murder of a prison guard that took place in 1972. Woodfox and two other men, Robert King and Herman Wallace, were convicted of the murder and held in Angola prison in Louisiana for decades. King and Wallace were eventually separately released and shortly after Wallace passed away. Human rights groups have appealed to the legal system for decades, maintaining that the trials were deeply flawed. Now, because a Louisiana judge refused to dismiss the case, the last remaining imprisoned of the three men, Albert Woodfox, will be tried yet again, even though most of the witnesses in the case have died. A U.S. district court had already ordered Woodfox's unconditional release by Louisiana, but Louisiana has continued to aggressively prosecute. Only intervention by a federal judge can now stop the case from commencing. Well, Christina, this case seems like such a travesty of justice, the entire case impacting all three men. Even the New York Times editorial board recommended that Albert Woodfox be released last year. What does this case represent to you?
Well, I think there are several issues, and this one case can point to the various issues that we face with this prison industrial complex, right? So you have the punishment of political activists, so the ongoing jailing of political prisoners, and apparently that's definitely part of the situation, as people have suggested that he and the other two were involved in hunger strikes in the 1970s, I believe. Then also the issue of mass incarceration, the various issues of that, the fact that there are millions of people who cannot participate in daily civic life because of their status as second-class citizens, the fact that people have been robbed of their lives when new DNA tests are continuously proving the innocence of some prisoners, that includes people on death row, the human rights abuses like solitary confinement, which is apparent in this case, that occur in prisons. And then so altogether, what you have, it represents a failed system that is hardly just. It plays the role of a neo-slave institution, as people like Michelle Alexander have pointed out, of course.
Christina, thank you as always for your analysis. We'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you.
Christina Mislan is an assistant professor of journalism studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Greek elections resulted in a second win for Syriza party leader Alexis Tsipras on Sunday. The embattled prime minister had faced growing uncertainty over his mandate after a stunning victory on an anti-austerity platform earlier this year and then a capitulation to creditors. The snap elections were a major risk, and pollsters had been unable to predict a clear victory. But Mr. Tsipras's party emerged with a plurality of votes. Still, only 56% of Greek voters turned out to cast ballots, much lower than in the two elections earlier this year. In his victory speech, Tsipras said the mandate that the Greek people gave us is crystal clear: to get rid of the wickedness and the regime of corruption and intertwined interests that have ruled the country for years. Syriza will have 145 seats in parliament out of 300. This is only four fewer than what it had when it first came into power. Joining me now is Harry Konstantinidis. He is a faculty member in economics at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Welcome to Uprising, Harry.
Good to be with you, Sonali.
How is it that the pollsters were unable to predict Tsipras's victory? He is claiming a four-year mandate now from the Greek public. But, you know, the fact that he would be reelected, that Syriza would get enough seats, was very much in question leading up to Sunday's election.
I think this has something to do with the way that pollsters have been operating in Greece. So in the lead up to the election, the pollsters were faced with a large number of undecided voters. So if you had looked at the latest opinion polls before the elections, you would see that approximately 20% of the voters did not know what to vote for. Primarily, these were a series of voters that had been disappointed. So in the lead up to the election, a significant chunk of these voters actually ended up going back and voting for Syriza, which made for this 7% difference between Syriza and the second party, New Democracy. So it was Tsipras managing to convince the undecided voters to come back to Syriza that made for this difference, which the pollsters were unable to predict.
What's really interesting is that after Tsipras won, the former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis wrote an op-ed in The Guardian entitled, "The lenders are the real winners in Greece. Alexis Tsipras has been set up to fail." And I'm wondering if you've seen this op-ed. He claims, Varoufakis claims, that the Greek leader won on three promises the Troika will make it hard for him to keep, the Troika being the group of three major creditors. What do you make of this?
I think he's probably right in some ways, but I think that he was also advocating for an impossible position. It is true that the austerity program that Greece has signed, that the Tsipras government signed in July, was a capitulation. It sets draconian targets, and it is a measure. It's a program that has so many recessionary measures that it is set up in a way that would make the Greek economy fail. And it's set up in a way that would make Syriza take the blame for the fail of the program. Now, having said that, unless you are willing to advocate for an exit from the Eurozone, in reality, there was no other option left. So it's after what we have seen over the last few months, it's very difficult to maintain the idea that the creditors were just bluffing and that they would not risk losing Greece because Greece would be the weakest link of the euro. So I think this idea, this strategy that the lenders are only bluffing, I think it came to its end. Mm-hmm. So Tsipras was faced with the option of either capitulating, either striking a deal and then setting up his party and setting up the government and trying to create an apparatus that would allow him to govern and at least do some progressive changes, or leaving the euro. And given that he was unwilling to do the latter, he had to opt for the former.
Now, the whole trajectory of what has happened to Greece under the Syriza party leadership has been so fascinating to the U.S. left, primarily because of the way in which the Syriza party rose from being an outsider to a leader of a major country, and that it did so on a platform that was very critical of the global capitalist system. Now this reversal has been quite a blow for the left, wouldn't you say?
I think we have to take some lessons, and I don't know that we are already in a position to actually evaluate what the lessons of the Syriza platform are. So I would suggest a little bit of caution in the way that we all of us interpretate these changes. So Syriza did come to power on the platform to end austerity. What we can't do this in one country only. So this idea that you would end austerity in one country only, or at least this imagination, was never part actually so much of Syriza's line. Syriza's platform basically suggested that we would go to the Europeans and we would convince them to end austerity, and we see that this failed. Now, we have taken some lessons about what the Eurozone really stands for, and we have taken some lessons about how the Eurozone operates, but I don't think that we have to be as pessimistic as sometimes we on the left tend to be. I think we have to take the lessons that we can and create new strategies. When one avenue fails, we have to be creative in finding another avenue of continuing this struggle. So in some ways, I don't think that the Syriza folks are going to stop being critical of the way that global capitalism, especially in its neoliberal form, operates. So I think they will maintain some of that, but under different constraints. I mean, in some ways, they had this realization about the things that they can and cannot do within the Eurozone. So now they have to be more experienced, now they have to be more determined, and now they have to find ways of promoting policies that would promote social justice, even within the context of this austerity agreement. It's very difficult, of course, but this is the challenge for the left, to always try to be creative. And that's something that we will have to judge them by.
Certainly the array of opposition that has so much more power is quite formidable. Just focusing on Tsipras for a moment, the New York Times, in describing his cabinet that he's put together and the government that he's formed today, said that Tsipras has achieved something that no other Greek leader has managed since the start of the economic crisis in 2009. He has won two consecutive elections and a national referendum, despite widespread speculation that his popularity would be short-lived and that one of Greece's more established parties would soon be back in office. So certainly he's proved to be an adept politician, but then again, that necessarily doesn't mean that it's something that people should necessarily emulate, should it? I mean, the point of the left is certainly to take power, but only if it can make change through taking power, not to simply remain in power for power's sake.
That's right. Yes, I agree with you on that. However, I do think that, I mean, we'll see is the truth, right?
Yeah.
In some ways, Tsipras was given a second chance by an electorate that was fed up with what was going on in Greece over the last 5 years. In some ways, I think it recognized that Tsipras was doing his best within the context of the Eurozone, and the Greek electorate did not want to leave the Eurozone. If they did, they would have voted for the splitter party, Popular Unity, which did not even enter parliament. So we have some signs that the Greek electorate wanted to push Greece and Europe to the left, but at the same time, it wasn't ready for the radical breaks that one would need if they wanted to, like, try to, I don't know, build socialism now, here and now. So in some ways, of course, then there's another question about whether Tsipras, you know, how does a leadership communicate, and how does it relate to the electorate? Should Tsipras be pushing people to the left, or should he be dragged by people to the center? And that's again an open question. And given that these people are not old school professional politicians for the sake of power, I would expect that they have to be challenged on how to keep finding ways of mitigating the terrible structural adjustment program that they've signed, and they have to find equivalent measures, and they have to find ways of mobilizing the people and building a more progressive, a more socially just Greece. And that's what to some extent the Greek people gave them a second chance to do. The Greek people gave them a second chance to do the reforms that Syriza claimed it didn't have enough time to do over the last 7 months. There may be some truth to that. Let's keep pushing them to the left, and let's judge them based on what they do. We'll see whether they are able to deliver. Clearly, the setting is very difficult in which they operate. The structural adjustment program tries in some ways to tie its hands, but there may be ways of creating ruptures and creating this spaces for confrontation with this neoliberal Europe. We'll see.
One of the things that also emerged in the election that hasn't gotten as much attention is the neo-Nazi Golden Dawn Party garnering 7% of the vote. What does this mean? Are they getting more or less powerful?
I would say it's about the same, and that's dangerous. They basically got a little bit more in terms of percentages than what they got last time. Their number of voters went down, though. So in the previous election, they had gotten 6.3% and approximately 390,000 voters. In this election, because of the lower turnout, they increased their percentage, even though they lost approximately 10,000 votes. So we know that there is a sizable part of the Greek population that has no problems whatsoever voting for a neo-Nazi party. Again, The question is, how do you stop this? The question is, how do you actually confront this in everyday life? How do you actually democratize the repressive apparatus of the Greek state? Because we know that in certain precincts where most of the special forces of the police were voting, the neo-Nazi party maintained its very high percentages in those specific precincts. So it's a process of actually confronting this and changing this in daily life. And that's, again, something that Tsipras and Syriza need to tackle immediately, actually, going forward.
Now, Harry, between the referendum over the IMF and the Troika's proposals and this second election of Alexis Tsipras, a huge social problem emerged in Greece and in other European states, and that was the problem of migration from countries like Syria, Libya, etc., this massive refugee crisis ramped up. It had been there at a lower level earlier, but it ramped up pretty seriously over the summer. Did that have any impact on the dynamics of Greek politics?
I think it may have had, I would say, a minor impact. We saw that Golden Dawn, and especially actually the New Democracy Party, the major conservative party in Greece, tried to capitalize on the frustration of some people who were living on islands with the refugee crisis. But at the same time, and here is a victory for Syriza and for the left in general, I think that the Greek population responded very calmly and with solidarity and with humanism to the refugee crisis. So if you compare the reaction of significant parts of the Greek population and the Greek political scene with other reactions that we have seen across Europe, I would say that the Greek people, despite the fact that they're in the eighth year now of a deep crisis, reacted with a lot of solidarity and reacted with a lot of understanding for the hardships that refugees are going through. So I think this was a proud, I mean, for me, like being Greek and not particularly, you know, like proud of being Greek in some ways, I think it was a moment where, you know, like it was a good moment to know that people are responding the plight of refugees in a very mature, in a very responsible, in a very humanist way, which is what you want. I mean, you want people to feel for others rather than to look for scapegoats. And I think that most people in Greece did that. And we saw a massive campaign of solidarity. We saw that especially the left and the anarchists in Greece did a very good job in like building the structures of support for refugees and immigrants. I think that people in general, even though the state doesn't have any capacity because of the crisis that we are in, people try to make up for that in a mature and progressive way.
Finally, Harry, the ordinary Greeks who might be sort of, you know, at their wits' end in terms of trying to see this financial crisis be solved, have taken to bartering and in order to make ends meet. And there was some really interesting news coverage, you know, of graphic artists exchanging designs for olive oil and people just doing this informal bartering and exchanging goods and services. And I'm wondering what you can tell us about that, you know, people's sort of ingenuity and innovation and making do with whatever they can.
Well, I think you see a lot of that over the last few years. This is not a new phenomenon. This is not something that just started like over the last 7 months. In some ways, you see the rise of different ways of people to exchange with one another and to conduct economic activity outside the traditional marketplace that we are familiar with. So we have seen the rise of social and solidarity, economy activities. I mean, so we've seen social pantries. We see people exchanging with one another over the last few years. We see local exchange trading systems and alternative currencies spring up in different parts of Greece. We see people exchanging without money and basically like exchanging time with one another. And to some extent, you know, like we are familiar with this social economy and solidarity economy efforts. They became crucial in the time of crisis. Now, to some extent, again, the question is, how do you deal with all these efforts and how do you help people realize their potential even in the midst of the crisis? And Syriza will be judged by how it responds to efforts like that. Syriza will be judged by how it relates and how it deals with self-management and self-organization efforts that have sprung up in different parts of Greece. And this is something that people need to press Syriza on, so that it doesn't, you know, like give the factories back to its to their old
Right.
owners, but it lets the workers around the factories, as they have been trying to do for the last couple of years, and have been facing hardships and difficulties from the legal system of Greece. So we'll see how it goes. And we have to keep pressing them, but I don't think that the story is done yet.
Harry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
My guest is Harry Konstantinidis, a faculty member in economics at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. This is Uprising. When we come back, Michelle Goodwin joins us. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Michelle Goodwin will join us near the end of the program. Discussion of race in the United States usually groups people into several broad categories: white, black, Latino, indigenous, and Asian, by which most people mean East Asian. But what about South Asians like my guest Deepa Iyer and me? What about Arab, Muslim, and Sikh communities? After the September 11th attacks in particular, these communities have worked to insert themselves into the discourse of racial justice in the United States. And writing about that is Deepa Iyer, former executive director of South Asian Americans Leading Together, SALT, who teaches in the Asian American Studies program at the University of Maryland. Her new book is entitled We Too Sing America: South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh Immigrants Share Our Multiracial Future. Welcome to Uprising, Deepa.
Thank you, Sonali.
Now, recently, there was a hate crime in Chicago against a Sikh man, Inderjeet Singh Mukher. And you open your book with the 2012 story of the Oak Creek Massacre. And we've seen in after September 11th, intermittent hate crimes against Sikh Americans in particular, because primarily likely of their turbans and beards that bigots mistake for being Muslim. And I'm wondering if these sorts of hate crimes you found in your research really ramped up strongly after September 11th. I know that's an obvious question, but I think it's important to sort of draw that line clearly.
No, definitely. I think it is important for us to know that obviously South Asians, Arabs, Muslims, and Sikhs were victims of hate violence well before 9/11, and I talk a little bit about the historical background of hate violence against these communities in the book. But as you said, Sonali, the hate violence really increased disproportionately in the weeks and months after 9/11. And we saw that in a variety of different ways. Unfortunately, there were murders, harassment on the streets, assaults, discrimination in public places, employment. But a lot of that actually tapered down a bit. However, over the last few years in particular, we have seen again sort of this uptick in terms of hate violence. And you alluded to the most recent horrific incident against Mr. Mukher, a father in Chicago who was assaulted while he was driving to the grocery store. And some of the reasons for this uptick is really around the media narratives that we continue to see that show that these communities are worthy of suspicion. that there's something wrong about them, that they're dangerous, and public policies that, again, continue to reinforce this public feeling that these communities should be profiled and targeted in some way.
Now, the name of your book, We Too Sing America, is, I understand, based on a line from a Langston Hughes poem. Can you share with us what you mean by this term, We Too Sing America?
Yes, about 90 years ago, Langston Hughes wrote a very poignant poem, I Too and the Darker.
We're having some trouble hearing you, Deepa. I Too Sing America was the first line of the poem, I Am the Darker Brother.
Right, that's right. And I thought that the poem really resonated with some of the themes in the book, because in the book, I'm trying to really document and uplift some of the stories of young people in the South Asian, Muslim, Arab, and Sikh communities who are often seen as others, in the same way that Langston Hughes portrayed Black people as others. But these individuals that I write about and so many others around the country are really trying to rebuild and reshape an America where all of us belong. And so that's why the poem really resonated with me.
I think that part of the complexity of how the United States deals with these myriad communities is that they are so complex. The histories are complex. The geographies are complex. The skin tones are varied. The dress is varied. The class privilege is varied. While many people in the South Asian and Arab and Muslim communities are immigrants, many are Muslim converts. Some in the Sikh community have been in the United States for generations. So does that complexity sort of muddy the waters, sort of prevent mainstream America from getting a clearer understanding? Because it's not a community that can be easily pegged.
That's true. And I think that the diversity in these communities are clearly a place where we can do better in terms of understanding what our histories are in this country and also what the commonalities are in terms of the experiences that South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh communities face, along with the importance of understanding shared histories, the importance of understanding how institutions of white supremacy have really created a situation for the post 9/11 communities that is around targeting, profiling, deportation. Part of what I'm hoping that this book will generate some conversations around is, how can we actually draw the links between our shared histories? How can we understand how institutions and policies are affecting communities of color in similar ways? And what do we do about that?
Would you say that before September 11th, many of these communities had sort of existed beneath the surface of the mainstream, going about their lives, in various ways, whether in academia or behind the counter of a convenience store or any other sort of way in which you can imagine people? But then 9/11 happened. And in your book, you have a section called 9/11 Racialized Us. And suddenly, many communities, to some extent, started to feel what it was like to be vilified. Although, of course, we should mention Muslim and Arab communities had long been stereotyped as terrorists. Mm-hmm. So
that's right. That's right. The writer Vijay Prashad often talks about how South Asians in particular were on racial probation before 9/11. And what I think he means by that is that South Asians could actually live under this guise, this lie, in a sense, that we were not necessarily victims of discrimination or subjects of bias or subjects of othering in this country. Even though, as you mentioned, that is not true. And we have many examples in South Asian American history where that othering has happened time and again. But certainly after 9/11, this racial probationary status that Vijay Prashad talks about really changed. And all of a sudden, South Asians, if you're talking about Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, anyone who looked brown and was from a particular part of the world became immediately suspect. And so what that meant was, in a sense, this sense of racialization, the sense of understanding, oh, okay, we too are people of color in this country who face similar forms of othering that other communities of color have felt. And I especially found this, in my time at SALT, when we would do workshops with young people, young South Asians, and we would ask them, what was your point of entry into understanding that you were a person of color? And almost everybody would talk about 9/11 being that moment of racialization, where they realized that, you know, their name, where they came from, their accent, their language, their faith, immediately put them in a situation at school where they were seen as being different, and different in a bad way. And so that is that idea of racialization that a lot of people have felt in South Asian communities since 9/11.
I love the section in your book where you describe or attempt to describe the hierarchy of race in this country. You say, at times, non-Black communities of color have colluded consciously and unwittingly to maintain white supremacy and its racial hierarchy in place. Our positions on the racial ladder in America dictate the opportunities, privileges, and entitlements that are available to us. Blacks are at the bottom while whites maintain the top position. Latinos, Arabs, and Asians fall in the middle positions. The racial ladder preserves white privilege while propping anti-Black racism. Racial groups in the middle maintain and reinforce this structure, sometimes with their consent. And Deepa, I thought this was really important. I had recently, one of my columns on Truth Dig addressed the issue of anti-Black racism among Asian communities, which is not something, you know, that people like to talk about, but I think does need to be maintained. So in acknowledging this racial structure, can we work to dismantle our place in it?
Acknowledging the racial structure is one important part of dismantling it, but then we have to really take the steps that are necessary. And so in the book, I talk about the importance of declining the so-called racial bribe, you know, the invitation, especially that is given to South Asian communities to climb up that ladder that you talked about, to embrace the false embrace of whiteness. We have to decline that invitation time and again, and do so vociferously and vigorously at every turn.
And for some people, I should say that's a little more challenging, because there are lots of people in these communities you describe who have light skin. Their names might sound foreign, but who can pass as white till their names come about. So for some, that's quite challenging.
Yes, and that is also something that I think we're going to have to confront when we think about race categories in this country, because even the construct, the census construct of what is white includes, as I mentioned in this book, Arabs. And many of the people that I talk to, Arabs, Kurds, and others, feel that whiteness is not a privilege that they face in any way, even if their skin color is more white, as you mentioned, or even if the government sees them as white. So these racial classifications are shifting. But I think, you know, going back to the point about South Asian and dismantling the racial ladder, acknowledgement is key, declining the bribe is key, but also what's important, and I think that we've seen some of this, especially with the movement for Black Lives, where we do see South Asians, Muslims, Arabs, and Sikhs making very key statements and stands about what it means to be in solidarity with the movement, and at the same time, actually attacking the anti-Black racism within our own communities that is very vicious. And so all of those types of acts and actions and acknowledgments, I think, need to occur for us to be able to dismantle the racial hierarchy.
And these complexities also exist within the Latino community, where there are, of course, skin tone variations, white Latinos, indigenous Latinos, etc. And speaking of Latinos, there's been a lot of collaboration, and I think quite heartening collaboration, between undocumented folks in the South Asian Arab Muslim communities and undocumented immigrants from Latin America countries. And that's an important aspect of the work that's being done today to dismantle racism in this country. Can you tell us a little bit about how the communities that you write about have joined the movement to advocate for the undocumented?
Yes. So Asian Americans have long been a part of the immigrant rights movement in this country because Asian Americans have really been seen as both undesirable immigrants at some points in our history, being called the brown horde, for example, coming over and changing our customs and culture. So we denied them naturalization, we denied them economic benefits and the like. But at the same, at other points in our history, we've seen Asian American immigrants as desirable immigrants. People who are coming over as entrepreneurs and investors and economic contributors and drivers. So this kind of push-pull tendency of the good and bad immigrant is something that Asian Americans are very familiar with. But what has been happening over the last 15 to 20 years is that Asian Americans, including South Asians, have in particular really been trying to eliminate this kind of dichotomy that exists of the good and bad immigrant by talking about how, in particular, centralizing undocumented immigrants. And some of the people that I mentioned in the book, like Eves Gomes, Hina Naveed, Bhupendra Ram, these are all young undocumented South Asian immigrants who have also taken leadership roles in talking about their own stories of deportation, migration, criminalization, and also making it very clear that there are undocumented South Asians in the Asian American community, and that they are a big part of trying to call for some of the changes to the immigration system. So it's important that Asian Americans are remaining kind of this force of centralizing how undocumented people are actually driving some of the changes that we're seeing in immigration at all.
And then finally, going back to the topic that we started with around the 9/11 racializing us, of course, outside the bounds of the United States, many of the people in the communities you described, South Asians, Arabs, Muslims, have relatives, have ties to the very countries that the United States has very, very, very destructive policies towards. And I'm wondering if people in these communities make connections between domestic policies and foreign policies that impact them.
Absolutely. You know, we've seen, for example, when the United States is very visibly involved in conflict in back our countries back home, that there is an impact here. So we have seen, for example, upticks in terms of hate violence, in terms of assault, name calling, and the like, when the United States is engaging abroad. But what we've also seen is a real conflict that many communities here face in terms of understanding what their own role is. You know, I specifically remember talking to many Kurds in Nashville, Tennessee, who talked about that, how they're feeling extremely conflicted about the United States government's role in the Middle East and how it's affecting them here. And so as we become a more diverse society, a more global society, I think we're going to have to have some of these conversations out in the open about what it means to be American, about what it means to be an American with, as you said, Sonali, families and relatives back home, how United States policies back home are affecting us here. Those are some of the conversations that we need to be having as our racial landscape shifts.
Deepa, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck with your new book.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest is Deepa Iyer. We've been talking about her book, We Too Sing, America, South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh Immigrants Shape Our Multiracial Future. Again, Deepa Iyer, last name I-Y-E-R. She's the former executive director of South Asian Americans Leading Together, or SALT. She teaches in the Asian American Studies program at the University of Maryland. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The International Business Times published an investigative report on Monday about how some states are now requiring inmates released on bail to pay for their own ankle monitoring bracelets. The report pointed out how poor Americans in particular, who get caught in the criminal justice system, are further impoverished by being forced to pay for their monitoring. A county in South Carolina contracts a private company called Offender Management Services to use GPS technology for this purpose. The company charges the people it monitors $300 a month, plus $179.50 setup fee. The story highlights the absurd depths to which the U.S. justice system has fallen. Mass incarceration has finally become the topic of much discussion, and one group of academics and legal experts who are especially focusing on women and girls in the mass incarceration system that is convening today at the University of California, Irvine. And one of the people who is joining that group and helping to organize it is my guest, Michelle Goodwin. She's a professor of law and chancellor's chair at the University of California, Irvine, and the founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy. Welcome to Uprising, Michelle.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Sonali. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, most of what mainstream America knows about women and girls in the prison system is sadly through the TV show Orange is the New Black. How sad is that, and how cut off from reality is that?
It's an incredible disservice, and here's what is important to know, that we've had some of the most staunch advocates for criminal justice reform in the White House and the administration, President Barack Obama and also former Attorney General Eric Holder, and both gave landmark speeches about mass incarceration, Barack Obama to the NAACP this summer and Eric Holder to the American Bar Association. And what was so fascinating is that in each speech, women were completely left out. It was as if women do not become incarcerated. It was as if we don't have girls of color, 10 years old, locked behind juvenile justice systems. The U.S. incarcerates more women than any other country in the world. We incarcerate more women than China, Russia, and India combined. And we can even toss in Brazil in there. It is a level of grotesque. And what is so absurd is that we ignore it. We pretend as if it doesn't exist. But those who happen to be impacted by this, the collateral damage of it, it's not just women, it's their kids.
Right.
So not only have we missed what's happening to women and the fact that their rate of incarceration, particularly for illicit drugs, is actually a higher rate than men, but we have also failed to take into account what this means in terms of foster care, what this means in terms of the health, emotional, physical, and psychological of their children. And one thing that is really startling is that now we have children being raised behind bars because some systems say that it's more progressive to allow the kids to be raised with their mother behind barbed wire and tall fences and gates. And it's absolutely stunning. And nobody says anything about it or pays any attention.
Hence the gathering today that you have helped put together. Let's mention that briefly now and then later. It's happening today at 12 noon at the campus of UC Irvine. It's called Women and Mass Incarceration, the U.S. Crisis of Women and Girls Behind Bars, featuring some incredible speakers, including Dr. Carl Hart, Linda Pence, and others. It's physically happening at 12 noon at the UCI campus, but people can watch the speakers and the proceedings online?
That's right. There will be a live webcast. So if they go online exactly to Google what exactly you've said, go into the UCI website, it's prominently listed, and they click a button and they can web stream and connect live with the conference. And it's such a powerful gathering. Any one of these individuals who are joining us today could have a full conference around their work. But today we have a dozen incredible speakers. Linda Pence, Carl Hart is coming, Claire Coles, Dr. George Woods. It's just extraordinary. Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, who's considered one of the leading constitutional scholars in the country, if not in the world. It's just an amazing group that's come together.
And we'll post a link at our website, uprisingwithsonali.com. And on, by the way, on Friday's show, we're going to feature interviews with three of the panelists that I'll be taping right after our live show today, Dr. Carl Hart, Pamela Alexander, and and Linda Pence. If you are lucky, fellow listeners, the KPFK general manager will allow that program to actually air and you will hear it. If you don't hear it on Friday, visit uprisingwithsonali.com to listen online. That's where all our banned broadcasts are going to be available. Now, Michelle, turning back to what you were saying earlier about the rate of women's imprisonment and incarceration in the United States, I think one of the reasons that women and girls' incarceration gets eclipsed is because of the sheer number of men being imprisoned. Vastly, the number of, when we look at the breakdown of numbers, vast majority of people behind bars are men. However, I thought what you said was really important. The rate of incarceration for women is growing much faster, even overall, not even when you look at just drug-related incarceration. The rate of incarceration for women is growing twice as fast as that for men.
That's exactly right. Well, you know, the criminal justice system has become an industry for us in the United States. And I think that two decades ago, people thought that that was just puffery, that there were people who were on the left and who were liberals who were just simply blowing smoke. But I'll tell you that between 1977 and 2007, the rate of incarceration for women grew by over 800%. And when you think about the fact that we have shut down factories, we've shut down places where people would otherwise work, people who come back from the military get jobs working in prisons and as police officers, this has become a central place where people can get jobs. 50 years ago, Sonali, no one would have advocated for there to be prisons literally located in their backyards. Now it's a major point where members of Congress, where people in rural communities fight to have jails and prisons literally in their backyards. Why is that? That's because they cannot find employment elsewhere, and these prisons and jails will employ them. It has become a way in which we're able to employ people, but it also means that we need people behind bars in order for that to work.
That is just a disgusting thing if you look at it, if you stand back and examine it, broadly speaking, the role that that the growing prison system is playing in our economy, needing more people behind bars so that people outside can gain employment. Michelle, one of the other things that I think is so important to talk about is girls and how girls are impacted by the criminal justice system. I'm wondering if you saw this report that was recently released. It was over the summer. The group Human Rights Project for Girls released an amazing report called The Sexual Abuse to Prison Pipeline, The Girl's Story. And this, I think, is an undercovered and underreported aspect of the prison industrial complex, is how girls who have been, the vast majority of women who end up in prison were sexually abused as girls. Can you reflect on that?
No, this is true. So our keynote speaker today is Sue Ellen Allen, who spent 7 years behind bars in Arizona and is the executive director and co-founder of an organization called Gina's Team. And Gina's Team works with girls who are in the juvenile justice system. And I've gone to speak in Arizona at these places. And I tell you, when you ask the young women there, how many of you have been sexually abused, hands raised throughout, it is a major pipeline. And we don't talk about sex in the United States, or we don't talk comfortably about it at all. And when you think about how long it's taken, for example, to address sexual abuse within the churches, I mean, it's been something that people have been complaining about literally for decades. And yet it's only been within the last few years that it's been taken seriously, even at the pontifical level. It's now Pope Francis who has appointed a commission to deal with this. And in the same way in the United States, it's also something we don't deal with. It's interesting, Sonali, there are lines of cases in the U.S. jurisprudence that said that young girls could not sue their fathers after rape because children were the property of their parents and that this would disrupt the family atmosphere. It has been a very long time for there to be any criminal justice reform in that area. The statutes of limitations toll quite closely to young people right after becoming an adult. So if you were molested between the ages of 3 and 13 and finally you're able to deal with it at 25, well, if you live in a state where the statute of limitations is 2 years after you turn 18, it's over.
Wow.
nothing can be done.
Wow. So when we talk about these problems, I think it's of course really important for us to start discussing solutions as well. And you know, allowing children to be raised by mothers behind bars is not a solution. And it's arguably even more cruel. I suppose there's a debate on that issue, whether they should be separated from their mothers who are in prison or be raised by them. But that obscures the bigger problem and how to solve it. Are solutions going to be discussed today?
They certainly will be discussed today. In fact, we'll have a closing panel that includes Dean Chemerinsky, Victoria Law attorney Linda Pence, who successfully defended Bebe Shui against first-degree murder charges when she attempted suicide in the state of Indiana, and also Sue Ellen Allen. And we will be talking about solutions. And you're right, you know, it's tough. You think about kid born behind bars. I mean, these stories are horrific. Children born in prison toilets. And what do you do? Wow. Do you keep a child behind bars? Or we know what U.S. foster care looks like. And Sonali, now there's privatized foster care. The New York Times and Washington Post have covered this, and there have been children who've died in privatized foster care. Of course, the federal system and state systems of foster care don't necessarily do far much better. But, you know, we have to think about solutions. We have to beg the question whether or not this drug war has worked. And so many now agree it's been a failure and it's been disparate in terms of how and when people are convicted associated with that. So we have to look at the drug war. We have to look at the fact that 2/3 of women behind bars are nonviolent offenders.
Well, Michelle, I want to wish you the best of luck for your event today, that you are one of several featured speakers alongside Erwin Chemerinsky, Dr. Carl Hart, and others. It's happening at the campus of UC Irvine from 12 to 4 p.m. I understand that the conference itself is sold out, so live streaming is available online, and we'll post a link there. Any last thoughts on the conference?
Well, I really appreciate your efforts to highlight these issues. We need to bring more attention to this issue. And when we do, we'll begin to see some significant changes. The one last closing thought that I'll share is that researchers have shown that children of incarcerated parents fare worse than children who've had a parent die.
Wow.
What does this mean then when 1 in 28 children has a parent in prison? What does that mean in the United States in terms of the children that we're hoping for a brighter future? What bright future can you have when you're suffering at such tremendous levels and no one is there to hear their cries and their concerns?
Michelle, thank you for all the work you do and good luck today.
Thank you so very much, Sonali. Have a wonderful day.
Michelle Goodwin, frequent guest chair on Uprising, is a professor of law and chancellor's chair at the University of California, Irvine, founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy. And we'll post a link to the live stream to the summit happening today from 12 to 4, called Women and Mass Incarceration, the U.S. Crisis of Women and Girls Behind Bars. That does it for our program today. Today is my last day live this week. The rest of the shows are taped for Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. It's because of staff cutbacks at KPFK because of funding problems. However, you may not hear the taped broadcasts because our general manager has chosen not to air them. If you don't hear the ones that we've taped for you, brand new programming, go to uprisingwithsonali.com. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. See you next time.